From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. New York Times columnist Nick Kristof knows his way around Africa, from its remote outposts to its bustling cities, from its war zones and despair to its gathering engines of growth. Net-net, here's what he sees. Africa rising. Maybe the world's new tiger zone of economic growth. Kristof says it's time for Americans to wake up to Africa's potential. China's pouring money in. He's just back from 12 days on the continent. This hour on Point, Africa's turn. Nick Kristof makes the case. You can join the conversation. Do you see it? Have you heard it before? Is this the time? Are you investing in Africa? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof. He got back on the 4th of July from his latest of many trips to Africa. His headline, Africa on the Rise. Nick Kristof, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
Great to be here.
And with us from Rice University in Houston, Texas, 22-year-old Jordan Skimmerhorn, a brand new Rice graduate. She won a competition to accompany Nick on his latest Africa sojourn to get an eyeful of Africa and the correspondence trade. Graduated in May with a degree in bioengineering. This was her first trip out of the United States to Malawi and Lesotho. Jordan, welcome. Great to have you as well.
Hi, Tom. It's great to be here.
Okay, Nick, first to you. You give us whiplash sometimes, my friend. The last time we were reading you from Africa was not very long ago, just last month. You're in Sudan along the Blue Nile and up in the mountains there, and you had a pregnant mother with a machine gun raking troops that were raping and pillaging, and it sounded like hell on earth, and now you're back, Africa rising. We're capable of, you know, carrying two images in our heads at one time, and yet it can seem like a stretch. What are you looking at here?
Well, frankly, part of the problem, I think, is that we in journalism always focus on the catastrophes. And, you know, in many ways, that's justified. The really newsworthy things are things like genocide in Darfur, or right now, famine and brutality in the Nuba Mountains of Sudan, or mass rape in Congo. But I worry that sometimes the result of that kind of reporting is that we leave readers with the impression that that is basically what Africa is about. And of course, it's not. I mean, there are many, many other parts of Africa that are increasingly peaceful, increasingly well-governed, increasingly the fastest-growing part of the world. And so on this Win a Trip journey, I wanted to kind of correct any misimpression I may be leaving with readers and underscore that larger context, which is indeed that I think that Africa is, on the whole, you know, with excluding places like Sudan, really on track to become a increasingly dynamic continent that Americans will ignore at their peril.
It's not just you, I guess, looking to make amends or balance the tough reporting that you do. I mean, you've got Goldman Sachs here with their latest report, Africa's Turn, and comparing business opportunities in Africa, you're right, with those in China in the early 1990s. Really, Nick? I mean, China went, you know, from just down near nothing in the early 1990s to, like everybody knows, world-beating. Does Africa have that kind of potential?
Well, I don't know. And I must say that predictions in general have not been very good. I remember when we lived in Asia, it was very sobering that the consensus had been that in the 1950s had been that, you know, Africa would grow much faster than Asia, mm-hmm. and that the two real economic dynamos in Asia would be Burma and the Philippines. And in fact, of course, every possible parameter there was wrong. But having said that, remember in the early 1990s, there was a consensus that China was not going to really do very well. That was after Tiananmen, and the government had been retreating. And then, then indeed, China truly came through. And I think that what we're seeing right now is, in the case of Africa, you know, it's very hard to be sure how things are going to go, but stars are aligning to think that Africa's growth may be much higher. Governance is improving dramatically. There are new findings of resources. Their demographics are improving. And indeed, already we're seeing, you know, really promising signs. Six of the world's 10 fastest growing economies since 2001 have been in Africa. Six of the world's 10 fastest growing economies, that is.
That's pretty amazing, of course. Some of that may be they start from a low base. On the other hand, growth is growth. I think Americans have a kind of learned skepticism. It may go all the way back to the 1950s you describe, when people saw independence coming and said, wow, this is a resource-rich continent. This could be amazing. And then it didn't happen. And we've got, you know, generations since then of failure to quite hit that bar. Beyond the demographics and the resources, I mean, what are the other indicators, Nick, that this may be the time? What's making Goldman Sachs, I mean, they're not in this for patty cake, say Africa's turn?
Well, there are a lot of different theories about why Africa has not been as promising as people had hoped. And some people blame colonial influence. Some people, I mean, there are all kinds of theories. I tend to think that governance is maybe the most important single factor. And the truth is that Africa has had pretty much terrible governance for the most part since 1960, when countries got independence. And that governance has been improving dramatically. There is still a real problem with corruption, but it's less than before. There is a tendency toward democracy, which tends to create more inclusive societies. The economies are moving much more toward the market, and that is leading to more investment in turn. We're beginning to see the emergence of middle classes in a number of countries that are creating demand for Western products. And agriculture, which is really the underlying base for Africa, is becoming much more promising. There's, you know, move toward irrigation, toward using more fertilizer, and the world is kind of recognizing that Africa may indeed end up being the world's breadbasket, as well as a growing source of resources like oil and gas.
And what about manufacturing? Is this mainly a natural resource base boom in a time when other economies have been hungry for those, China foremost, but not only China? Or is there an industrial growth on top of that huge resource base?
That has actually been disappointing, and I think that is a real weakness of Africa, that it has not done well with manufacturing. It has done some manufacturing for internal purposes. It has done some agriculture processing and some resource processing, but it has, for the most part, not been competitive internationally. And one of the problems has been that the kinds of things that Africa produces, like oil and gas, they may create wealth overall, but they don't create jobs. And so the result has been in countries like Angola or Chad has been that on paper the country is getting richer, but that doesn't always translate into an improved standard of living for ordinary people living in villages around the country. And so I think that is one of Africa's real challenges, to try to figure out how to spread the benefits around and make sure that this rising tide does lift all boats.
Jordan Skimmerhorn, here you are, 22 years old, just out of Rice University. Until you hopped on the plane with Nick, had not been out of the United States, and then suddenly there you are in Malawi and Lesotho and staring Africa in the face. So give us your kind of, you know, first impression, Jordan. Does this look to you like a boom waiting to happen, or maybe happening now? Your first impression of Africa?
Yeah, it was quite a first trip. We did see a lot of entrepreneurship on the ground in individual communities. People would collect savings from their small businesses and then use those savings to reinvest in those businesses. So yes, I would say we saw a lot of that.
So here you were in factories. What was it in Lesotho where they're, I think it's Chinese textile or manufacturing companies, garment companies, making stuff that's going to show up at The Gap and Nordstrom's and JCPenney.
Yeah, that was great. We saw denim mills, people stitching together sweatshirts that looked exactly like something I would buy off the rack.
Did Africa say to you, Jordan, economic powerhouse?
From what we saw, yes it did, especially in the capital cities of Lesotho and of Malawi.
Yes, what? Because the raw material's there? Because it's happening already? Because why?
There seemed to be a lot of hope, especially with recent investments and successful political transitions. People seemed to look at what they were seeing around them, to look at job growth, and to have faith that that would continue.
And Nick, what you're saying here, the thing that's one big piece missing in this picture is American business. Now, it surely must be there, I guess, in oil exploration and drilling. But you're looking around compared to China and others at this point. Foreign direct investment, we're outstripped by any number of others, and saying, where's the American profile?
Yeah, frankly, I think American business is tended to be a little behind the curve, and then it tends to notice that and sort of rush in. I sure noticed that living in China, where for a long time American business seemed largely oblivious to the opportunities, way, way behind Japan, for example. And then in about 1993, 1994, they noticed that and poured into China, and these American negotiators who would go in to meet their Chinese counterparts and say, you know, beam and say, look, I just want you to know I have a direct order from my CEO to make this deal work. And well, of course, then they would get completely raked over the coals,
right,
and ripped off. And I think there's something similar, frankly, now in Africa that, as you alluded
to. Hello, Nick?
A disaster zone, a bog, and it's not on people's radar screen. And in fact, other places around the world, whether China, India, to some degree Europe, are noticing those opportunities, and those companies are more eager to go in. So, I mean, it's not surprising that everywhere you go around Africa, you see these Chinese entrepreneurs. And the American reaction to that has been to see a security threat. And so the people who've been proactive on Africa policy has frankly been the American military. They've established the African Command, AFRICOM. But American business has frankly kind of missed the boat on this, I think.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about Africa as maybe the next boom continent. Against all of our presumptions and a lot of tough realities, it is on the move. China gets it. It's in there. We're asking, what about the USA this hour? Nicholas Kristof is with us, columnist for the New York Times, just back from 12 days in Africa, writing Africa on the Rise. Along with him for that trip, 22-year-old Jordan Skimmerhorn, just a brand newly minted graduate of Rice University, won an essay contest to go along with Nick, first time out of the U.S., and she was right into the thick of it. She joins us today from Houston, Texas. Here's a little word from Kenya, the first geothermal-powered flower farm there. The engineering director, Bruce Knight, talks about what his African-based company offers.
Our costs are less, our quality is guaranteed, and we produce a better quality flour cheaper than anyone else.
China's in there like crazy. Here's a Ghanaian man on YouTube expressing his excitement about Chinese investment in Africa.
For me personally, I really like to work with the Chinese because of the experience. Because they have enormous technology that we want to tap in. You know, their technology is so advanced.
I really like to work for the Chinese, says the Ghanaian there. Here's Helen Hai from China's Huajian Group, showing off her shoe factory in Ethiopia. And this is a promotional video. They produce 2,000 pairs of shoes every day in Ethiopia.
Today, I'm very proud to tell you, on January the 5th, 600 workers, 2 production lines, all new brand machines, we started to produce shoes for the U.S. market with the shoes with the label Made in Ethiopia. When we first started, we also made a decision which we recruited 86 Ethiopian university graduates. We took them to China to our training school to teach them how to make shoes.
Chinese owned, made in Ethiopia. Here's the Chinese ambassador to Guinea, Xiao Li Jing, describing the relationship as he sees it between China and Africa, in this case, the Guinean government.
The Guinean government wants to develop, but it doesn't have the capital. But we, the Chinese government, have the money, but we need some kind of resources. So the Guinean government can use the investment from China to develop their country, and we, the Chinese government, can get some resources from Chinese companies investing here.
The Chinese ambassador there, just one of many countries in which China's footprint is very substantial at this point. We wonder if the U.S. is missing out on the big next growth frontier here, and what that would mean for Africa. We'll talk with Nick Kristof and Jordan Skimmerhorn about it. We've got a lot of callers for you, Nick and Jordan. Bill in New York, North Creek, New York. Bill, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I teach at Georgetown University, and I have a number of Nigerian and Ghanaian African students there, as well as my son, Christopher, who read Nick's article in the Times and got very excited about it. We're trying to, as a small company, to make contacts with the right people in the United States and Africa to promote investment in low-income housing and to build that housing in Nigeria and Ghana. But we're running into trouble with crime and corruption as impossible problems for us as a small group to solve. I was wondering if your listeners could comment on that.
Hey, Bill, let me just ask you, I'll take it to Nick Kristof, low-income housing as a profit-making enterprise?
As an affordable, it could be for-profit or non-profit, either way. We just are having difficulty getting it done, even though we have access to acreage.
Nick Kristof, what do you say? There's an American, wants to do business in China, crime and corruption, looking back at him.
I think that there is a potential market for low-income housing in the developing world, and the Acumen Fund has been a leader in that. But, look, crime and especially corruption, they're real obstacles, and I don't want to minimize them. And Nigeria, which your caller mentioned, has a particular problem with corruption. In general, countries that have had a lot of oil and gas or the resources tends to fuel this kind of corruption, and which an awful lot of officials are on the take. It may be that he might be better off looking at other countries that have better governance, where everybody is a little less likely to have their hands sticking out.
Nick, is that a problem for China, or does China just play the game, and does that put the U.S. at a disadvantage?
Corruption is a problem for all players, and other people tend to pay those bribes. But I must say that there has been a migration toward economies that work better. I mean, if you look at Rwanda now, then mm-hmm. Rwanda has a real problem with political oppression, but economically, it is indeed very honest. You don't have major corruption problems. It is very efficient, very well run. Ethiopia, likewise, has a problem with political oppression, but economically is increasingly well run. Ghana is becoming increasingly impressive, and with its own little high tech sector. So there are a growing number of places. Botswana has been kind of the pioneer in good governance for all of Africa. And it's not an accident that investment tends to go to those places that are, more market-friendly, more investment-friendly, and a little less likely to have officials having their hands sticking out.
Well, look at what that political oppression might mean longer term. Nothing to sneeze at. Joe Henry in Isle of Mott, Vermont. Joe Henry, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
My family are Portuguese, and I was in Lisbon this winter, and my cousin's son, who has actually dual citizenship, has to go to Angola. He took the 2-year contracts. There's the thing that's going for Africa is this perfect storm of economic chaos in Europe from its former colonial masters and all of this intellectual academic drain going to Africa. So
you say he has to go, Joe Henry, to Angola. Why? He has to go because he can't find work in Portugal?
He couldn't find a job for almost 2 years. And his wife has a job, but it becomes one of those double whammies where she has to stay in Lisbon and he has to go somewhere else. And for a lot of Portuguese, especially teachers and young people that can't get jobs, is to go to Angola and Mozambique and Guinea and Cape Verde, wherever somebody's going to hire you. And, of course, the crim of Portugal goes to Brazil, because they're the ones that pay the most.
That is really interesting. Thanks for your call. Nick Kristof, how do you see the global economic problems right now affecting Africa's prospects? Do they...
It's fascinating that, and I think one of the things that a lot of people have noted is kind of a symbol of the rise of Africa vis-a-vis Europe, is that Portugal has been seeking financial assistance, given this economic crisis in Europe, has been seeking financial assistance from, indeed, its former colony of Angola, former war-torn catastrophe of Angola. And now Angola, because of oil and gas, has been increasingly prosperous. And so I think that that is emblematic of part of the change there. I would say that indeed Africa has been hurt by the crisis in Europe and the downturn around the world. It's fewer markets for its goods, but on the other hand, it's been hurt less than than many other places. It is less linked to the world economy, and that has provided a limit to the downside.
Jordan, I wonder, when you looked out across the sea of caps and gowns at your graduation at Rice, and you know your classmates there, you just spent 4 years with them, you're 22 years old, and a lot of them about the same, does Africa look like a destination where they might, you know, fruitfully go? Can you see them, you know, like our Portuguese friend calling in, can you see them going to Africa to, as people have gone like crazy to China and India, to find a foothold in the economy and maybe in the process help Africa develop?
Yes, something I noticed in college was that a lot of my peers were very interested in social entrepreneurship and in finding a job that can help them make money but also do some social good. And I think Africa is very ripe for that right now.
Can I just butt in there?
Yeah, Nick.
I mean, Jordan is actually an example of that. As a college student, she devised a medical device to treat babies with something called apnea, and that device has been field tested in Houston, and it may indeed now be rolled out in some African countries. And so Jordan may be one of those people who does go out there to oversee the development of this device, and you know, it may end up in hospitals around the world.
Nick, you write that we've historically thought of Africa as a place for, you know, sybaritic safaris or masochistic aid missions. And now you're painting another kind of target there and saying Americans are missing it at this point. We've got listeners, though, also expressing some skepticism about this. I mean, here Shiva says, with China, India, other countries buying vast tracts of farmland in Africa, are we slowly returning to the colonial era? Alex says, is this a cynical attempt by power structures in Washington and to beyond to recolonize Africa, steal their vast resources, drive out the Chinese in a game of geopolitical chess? Nick?
Well, this question of outside powers buying up or leasing up vast tracts of agricultural land is something that has been much debated, and we're seeing in countries, you know, hundreds of thousands of acres sometimes being taken up. And a lot of people do worry that this is a kind of new colonialism, that the people actually on the ground will be hurt. I'm a little bit ambivalent about that. On the one hand, I think that it's a chance actually to bring improved farming techniques to these areas. The agricultural yields in Africa are only about one-third of the global average, so there's a real chance to improve output, bring new technologies there, teach local people how to improve farming, bring in new kinds of crops, like the flowers that the fellow mentioned in Kenya.
Mm-hmm.
But the downside is that there's also a real potential for corruption, where officials in the capital end up leasing away large tracts of land that there are local subsistence farmers on, and they just end up getting pushed out. And there are real concerns about this in South Sudan, in Ethiopia, in some other countries. So in theory, I think it's something that I'm very sympathetic to, but I worry a lot about the disenfranchised end up being, you know, really big losers from that.
And what about the efficacy of this kind of investment versus the kind of aid that Africa is? I mean, let's just think of it from a 100% African perspective. What's the path to better lives for people there? What's the more effective path? Working in a Chinese, I don't know, molybdenum mine, will that do it? We've got people writing about how you got to work in a mine in Zaire, Chinese mine, for 2 years before you get a helmet.
Well, I mean, in general, I think that there is evidence that long-term development comes more from trade than from aid. And aid, look, I'm a huge believer in aid. My Sunday column just now was about, you know, aid to write to combat AIDS. We need aid to build education levels, this kind of thing. But at the end of the day, to really get economic development, you need jobs, you need economic growth, and that comes more from investment and trade. And you know, in terms of the mines, look, conditions are sometimes pretty dismal. I remember I was the first outsider to go into a diamond mine in Congo after the fall of the Mobutu regime.
Mm-hmm.
There. And I remember, I think it was All Things Considered, called me up and, you know, was clearly looking for a kind of a story where these wonderful diamonds come from these horrible conditions. it's really more complicated than that. Those miners there, I mean, they were very happy with those jobs. I mean, they were grim, the conditions were terrible, but they were an improvement over people dying of malaria in their home villages. And so I think that jobs are, people in those villages will see those jobs as an improvement and as a escalator to a better life. And I think it would be a mistake for us to scoff at them because they're, because the conditions are, from our point of view, really terrible.
I mean, when you go the development path, there's always those balance and trade-offs. I mean, years ago, I remember in Congo, I was on Lake Kivu across from Rwanda and went from just hellish refugee camps there to this glittering mansion. A Euro businesswoman there, and her business, she had the Marlboro cigarette concession for that region. She was doing great, but I don't know. But it cuts both ways. Dave in Des Moines, Iowa. Dave, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Back in the 80s, I was an hourbound instructor at the Ole Tok Tok Mountain School in East Africa in Kenya.
Mm-hmm.
And my partner, Dr. Mike Greenberg, he's from Philly, noticed that in the village of Naramuru, which is near Mount Kenya, that there was a lot of tourism, mountain climbing going on, and all the guides were European or American. And Mike spent a considerable amount of time training a lot of the local men there to become mountain guides and very proficient climbers. And the legacy has lasted to the point where this is kind of the badge of honor for all these men in this village, and they're known as the best climbers. And I think it surprised them, and it surprised everyone around. I mean, they're some of the world's finest climbers now and finest guides.
Well, I mean, and why not? We've seen Kenyans just take home the gold all over the place on that front. But as a metaphor or a symbol of what's possible here, Dave, when you look at Africa based on that little tiny keyhole of a story, do you see, okay, this could be the next economic tiger, the next boom zone with Africans benefiting?
Absolutely. Just like anywhere. I mean, Arkansas could be the next boom zone if, the people were educated and given half the opportunity. I mean, it's where we put our focus, and people are people. And they're darn good climbers in Naramuro, and I'll take my answers off the air. Thanks.
Dave, thank you for your call. I mean, Jordan, is that the gut feeling you came away with, really, honestly, here, 22 years old and looking at this, saying, yep, this could be it?
It was, especially in many of the villages. Once people had a little bit of assistance, a little bit of agricultural training, they really took that sort of thing and ran with it. We spoke to one woman who had assistance with irrigation. Her community had been given foot pumps to pump water into their fields. And after some time, she used that to save up enough money to buy a motor pump, so she didn't have to put in the manual labor.
Mm-hmm.
I think things like that really parallel that story.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Africa as maybe the next boom continent against a lot of people's presumptions and impressions and against a lot of tough realities. It is on the move. Six of the fastest growing economies, six out of the top 10 in the last decade. African, seven out of the top 10 predicted for the next half decade. China gets it. It is in there. What about the U.S.? Nick Kristoff is a Pulitzer Prize winning columnist for The New York Times, just back from 12 days in Africa with Jordan Skimmerhorn, who wrote the competition-winning essay that put her in the co-pilot seat there, just out of Rice University, 22 years old, first time out of the country, looking at the correspondence trade and at Africa alongside Nick. She joins us from Houston. Nick's in New York. China in there doing a lot of things, a lot of business. The government also sort of ladling out money for all kinds of shiny projects. Here's Africa's Issa Suma showing off a new stadium he's responsible for in Guinea. It opens this summer. It cost the Chinese $50 million to build.
In Guinea, we love football. It's a national priority to have sporting infrastructure. If you want to develop sport, you need sporting infrastructure. So with Chinese cooperation, we asked for a stadium of 50,000 seats that could contain many spectators. And that's what you see right now.
Boom, $50 million, 50,000 seats, and there's a new stadium in Guinea. American businessmen are there. CNBC caught up with Chicago-based American businessman Quinton Primo in Nigeria, where he said he expects 40 to 50% returns on his real estate investments. Forbes lists him as one of the 10 wealthiest black Americans.
A city like Abuja, the capital city, has
Nigeria
has 4 to 5 million people and one decent hotel. And that hotel runs a 98% average occupancy and very, very little housing, very little adequate housing. So housing for low, moderate, high-income individuals, first and foremost. Secondly, commercial. There are no hotels. The office product is shoddy. There are no real malls. I mean, all these things create all these opportunities are ones that we will pursue.
There you go. Chicago man Quinton Primo saying opportunity and acting on it in Nigeria. Lots of callers. Mugumi in Woburn, Massachusetts. Mugumi, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, yes, Tom. I'm sorry. It seems like the fire alarm is going off in my building.
Oh.
I'm calling because it seems like for sure American businesses are missing out big time in Africa. For example, I'm from Uganda originally.
Uh-huh.
And Uganda discovered oil in the last about 5-10 years. A small company came in there, invested about $150 million, and just recently they sold their shares, almost about $2 billion. That's how much money they are making. And China is just moving in there. You have a lot of companies from China that are investing. They know, they see the potential in Africa, and I'm glad that the journalists at least went ahead and wrote this piece, because most of the news we get about Africa in the Western media is all about wars and genocide, but there's a huge, huge, huge potential.
Mugumi, do you think that American companies do you think American companies can be as successful as Chinese companies in Africa, Mugumi?
Well, America, I think America should take that advantage and invest in Africa, because you have a growing educated population. For example, if you went to Uganda, a lot of university graduates on the streets of Kampala, they are looking for work, and that is the potential in itself.
Yeah. Mugumi, I appreciate your call. Maybe you should step out of that building for a minute here, but thank you for calling in. Let me get one more, and I'll bring it to you, Nick and Jordan. Darius in Burlington, Vermont. Darius, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thank you so much. You know, I've been following your talk every day. Nick, I'm really proud of what you have done in South Sudan and in Darfur. You know, I have been following your reports, and you have done a wonderful job. What I really wanted to ask you about is, even in, you know, chaos of South Sudan, you know, there are really economic promises. You know, if American, you know, private investment could get involved in it. And I think sometimes the reports kind of scare people, but, you know, I really wanted, you know, Americans to get in. And I am a U.S. citizen now, and I kind of look at Chinese getting into South Sudan, for instance, for oil investment and so on. It's envy, because as a U.S. citizen, I really wanted to see, you know, part of my country over there in South Sudan. And we would really like to see something come out of that. Economic woes, you know, the South Sudanese are facing.
Darius, let us pick it up right there, if I may. Today we've got the first anniversary of the independence of South Sudan, and as Darius says, Nick, you've written a lot about it, and they've had tough problems and stories there. I mean, just the one you wrote last month out of the Nuba Mountains there with the pregnant mom. Her baby was born. She named it after the Fakao, the word they use to say, watch out, bombers are coming to drop bombs. And she says, you know, she's ready to, she says, if I see the enemy again, I'll tie this baby to my back and pick up a gun and fight them. It doesn't exactly sound like a rotary lunch, Nick.
No, you don't want to mess with those Nubans, boy. And look, you know, there's a real challenge for us as journalists to figure out what it is that we should cover. And I make no apologies for covering genocide, mass rape, malaria, maternal mortality, all those grim things. But I really do worry sometimes that kind of focus of journalism leads people to have a misimpression of the larger truth of Africa. And the basic problem is that we in journalism, we cover planes that crash, not planes that take off. And in America, we understand aviation. We sort of assume that, okay, we're writing about this crash, but there are lots of others taking off. But in terms of Africa, I think readers and viewers don't have that broader context in which to understand the picture. And so if all they read about is plane crashes, they assume that Africa is littered with plane crashes. And in fact, there are an awful lot of planes taking off, and that is increasingly true. And so how we as journalists convey that, I think, is a real challenge, and we have to think more deeply about it.
But here's my question for you, Nick. Darius is calling in. He's from Sudan, South Sudan. He would like to see U.S. investment there, and it's still a pretty tough area. I mean, you've seen how China's going. Do you think American companies are gritty enough to get into this arena, to get into the tough spots? And you know, you're going to be far from, from a Hilton hotel there.
I think that American businesses could if they tried hard. Now, look, South Sudan can be a messy place to operate. But on the other hand, I remember when a hotel in Juba, in the capital of South Sudan, there was such a shortage of hotel space that entrepreneurs were able to rent out tents and charge $250 a night for sleeping in a tent. And that attracted a rush of investment from Uganda, from Kenya, from other countries, and people build up hotels. And Americans were not really players at that. One of the things that I've seen that makes me indeed more optimistic is that there are a lot of Africans who emigrate to the U.S. I mean, African Americans of a recent vintage, people who were maybe born in Africa and came to the U.S. as university students, who are now going back to Africa as investors. And that mimics what we saw with China, where Hong Kong and Taiwanese were going into China and invest, and what we've seen with India, with Indians abroad going back to invest in India. And it seems to me that maybe they'll be leading, these African Americans will be leading the way, and I hope that others will follow.
Mary in Dothan, Alabama. Mary, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hello. I wanted to ask about one of those plane crashes that your reporter referred to, Zimbabwe. They have your guests have mentioned many of the countries in Africa, but not Zimbabwe. I was there 2 years ago and am still in contact with a friend I made, mm-hmm. and there seems to be absolutely no hope for that country. And I know elections are coming up in November, and she has expressed through her emails, great concern about what is going to happen in her country.
Yeah, hope versus the opposite, Nick. Zimbabwe's not the only place, but you hear Mary's concern.
I mean, Zimbabwe is indeed a crashing plane, and it's just heartbreaking to go to Zimbabwe these days and watch what has happened. There, I think the best hope is indeed that Mugabe dies hurriedly, and that there is some danger that he'd be succeeded by a collapse in a failed state. But I think that the neighboring countries are, so determined to put the pieces back together again that Zimbabwe will have a pretty good chance of a resurgence under new leadership after Mugabe is gone.
But boy, sometimes the wait can seem eternal there.
He seems immortal, unfortunately.
Barry writes to us on Facebook and says, what about human capital in Africa combined with high tech and connectivity in places like Rwanda, positioning itself as an IT hub in East Africa? How realistic might it be for a wired African workforce to enter the global tech marketplace? Can parts of Africa compete on this turf, Nick?
I wish I could say that it will become competitive. Rwanda is trying. Some other countries are trying. One of the problems has been that the pipeline of internet access into Africa has been limited, and that has raised prices of bandwidth and has made it harder to compete. In Senegal, you do have some companies that are providing tech support and caller support via the internet to France, for example. But this hasn't been anything like what India has been doing for the U.S., for example. And human capital has been dramatically improved across Africa. It used to be a huge problem that the educated class, especially university educated people, that was very thin at independence. And now that's been improving dramatically. But I think to compete around the world with other high tech sectors in English, I think that is going to be pretty tough.
And here's Jeff writing to us, Nick, online, and wondering about this emphasis on economic growth and development. He says that he agrees. He says the resources are incredible and the people are enthusiastic and ambitious. The people in power, however, are still thinking short term. Even Kagame, Paul Kagame, this is president of Rwanda you mentioned earlier, who our listener says has been among the best but is acting despotic. And he asks, where will the pressure come from to improve if we just go for the profits, Nick?
Well, I hope that the pressure will come from the U.S., and indeed I wish the U.S. government would put more pressure on countries like Rwanda and Ethiopia, which have so much going for them economically, but I think jeopardize that with really brutal political repression. And because these are our allies, I think we are, too quick to excuse them. But having said that, if you compare Africa and even the despots today with those of 20 years ago, there has been just a dramatic improvement. There's a joke about Africa that I think is instructive. It goes that there were classmates from Africa and Indonesia at Harvard Business School. And they were friends there, and then 20 years later, they were each finance ministers in their country, and the African finance minister goes to visit his Indonesian counterpart, and he goes to his country home, and he sees this palatial home, and they're in the living room there, and he says, "This is amazing, but how do you afford this on a government salary?" And the Indonesian minister points out the window and says, "You see that highway out there? 10%. Well, a couple of years later, the Indonesian goes and visits the finance minister in Africa and goes to his even more palatial residence and asks the same question, how do you possibly afford this on a government salary? And the African finance minister points out the window and says, you see that highway? And the Indonesian minister looks and says, no, where? And the African says, well, that's exactly it, 100%. And that kind of has been the way the governance in Africa has proceeded until recently. It's no longer true. There is real corruption, but it's nothing like as bad as it used to be. And it's one of the things, it's the trend that matters, not the absolute level of corruption. And there's real improvement there.
Well, the trend matters. There can't be any question about that. But we've got listeners pushing back. Janet has spent time in Rwanda, said, enormous problems. Even there, government has to have a significant say in cut of the business for you to stay in business. I've known expats who had to literally flee in the night to Uganda because false charges were brought against them by the government after they publicly denounced government corruption. I don't know the details, but there's one response. Kinfei in Clarksville, Tennessee. You're on. Thanks for calling, Kinfei.
Hi, Bob. I'm Ethiopian born, but American citizen.
Yeah.
I'm really worried about China's was taking it over on Ethiopia. More Ethiopians are very concerned about their products, others. But Americans, they should take over that perspective about Ethiopia, so it's going on right now. But as the corruption and crime, there isn't such crimes in Ethiopia. But corruption side, the government was working hard to get that corruption, and there's a role passed by the government, and so Ethiopian is really work hard, but the Western media was no other Ethiopians really bad side. People ask me America, where I'm from, and when I say Ethiopia, they're scared. Oh, you're fat. And Ethiopians are really, really working hard to get like Americans do. So as Americans, we should invest in Ethiopia, take over the Chinese.
Kinfei, I appreciate your call. Ethiopians as workaholics, and don't forget it, but you hear the concern there about China. Nick, maybe there's more than, obviously there's more than a growth issue here. And what about the political ramifications of whose footprint is larger here in terms of Africa's own future political complexion, Nick?
It's interesting that we're beginning to see more grassroots resentment against the Chinese presence around the continent, just because people see these Chinese companies coming in, and you know they do appreciate a lot of these investments, these new stadiums, the new hospitals, the scholarships that are offered, but there's also a resentment at what they see as exploitation, at the role in corruption, this kind of thing. And in Zambia, it was a real issue in the election there. Jordan and I were in Malawi, and the president took action against the way Chinese entrepreneurs were taking up stores, retail stores, in villages around the country. So there's anxiety in many African countries about this growing Chinese presence, and that just makes it even more hospitable for Americans, and we're not taking advantage of that.
Jordan, your first time out of the country, do you think Americans have the grit, the vision to get in there, into Africa?
I hope so. And if not, I think the Chinese will instead of us.
Well, it's happening right now. You brought the story back for us. We're grateful for it. Jordan Skimmerhorn, new graduate of Rice University, off with Nick Kristof on a 12-day trip to Africa. Jordan, thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
And Nick Kristof, thanks as always for the insights. Thanks for joining us, Nick.
Great to be with you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks to you as well. This is On Point.